The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Now we're witnessing a divergence, a decoupling, where the emerging markets are falling apart first. And you know what's amazing to me is it's only in the West do we somehow think that we are immune. And what this suggests to me is that 2008 and 2009 was not the last time that pride and hubris preceded the fall.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, this is a profound week. There's several things in the last 17 years that have happened in this country on this particular week that have changed, really, life in America.
You know, as I looked at Barron's and the Wall Street Journal and The Economist, there were so many articles that kind of brought those two realities together of 9/11 almost two decades ago,
right,
and the end of Lehman Brothers, which was just 7 years after that, and now a decade in the rear view.
It's the same week in September, just different years. So it was September 11th of 2001, of course, and we all know what happened there. And then Lehman was the week of September 11th as well, when they closed the doors.
And for me, it's a reminder of how quick time passes. A day passes and you think nothing of it. You've got months and even years that can slip by almost without notice and sometimes without account. And a decade seems to almost pass unimaginably fast. And, and frankly, I don't think of it except for when there is significant events. And maybe it's the two that we mentioned, or maybe it's a child's birthday or an anniversary. But these are the things that mark time. In grade school, what marked time was going back to school in the fall. And then you had the summer months, but it was always punctuated by going back to school. Now, as an adult, it's a little different.
Speaking of going to school, my greatest education, Dave, honestly, has been the last 10 years of doing this weekly commentary with you. The guests that we've had on, it's hard to believe, isn't it, that it's been a decade that the Lehman crisis hadn't even occurred when we started this commentary.
That's right. Lehman, if I'm not mistaken, was in the seventh month of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.
Mm.
And now it's over a decade ago. So, I mean, time passes, and it's a reminder to me of what matters most in life. As you look at how quickly events occur, relationships are the core of our human experience and the most important thing that we involve ourselves in. So, I mean, there is the macabre side of me, which is time also is a reminder of our mortality. Again, back to relationships. I've been married for nearly 20 years. My parents are getting ready to celebrate their 50-year anniversary together. The company, just a few more seasons will pass, and we'll pass that five-decade mark as
I was talking to my wife the other day, and we had just gone to a party that was saying goodbye to friends of ours that they've been in town for 25 years, and they're moving now. And we looked at the people, and the people at this particular going-away party, none of us really even had to talk to each other, Dave. We were all like family. We had had the ups, we had had the downs together, and we realized the only thing that really does matter is the relationship. You know, we really have this here at this company. That's something that we really value, because the company's been around 47 years. A lot of the guys here have been here four decades, and you know, we've watched each other grow up, but we've also watched, I mean, this is a good example, Lehman. Lehman had not happened when we started the commentary. We got to week by week by week see it coming and then talk about it in the rearview mirror. You know, I think about the first year that I was here, 1987. That was the year when nothing could go wrong for the stock market. I remember reading Fortune magazine. I've said this on the commentary before, but Fortune magazine that summer said, "Are stocks too high?" And they said, "No." Mockingly, they said, "You know, there's new ways of valuing the stock market. It's going to go on forever."
You have the same language today.
And Bob Prechter. Okay, Bob Prechter said the exact opposite. Your dad and Bob Prechter were saying, no, this fall, we could have the greatest crash that we've had since 1929. And guess what happened?
They nailed it. Well, I spoke to Bob this week, and he's been working in and around the markets for over four decades, working with technical analysis and drawing on what he calls socionomics. But, you know, if you look at it, he's certainly drawing on his degree in psychology from Yale. And I have a number of thoughts that relate to the market and the technicals and his team. But before we get there, there's a conversation that I had this week at the breakfast table, and it was about critical decision making. critical decision making under pressure. And we looked at a phrase from the book of Isaiah towards the end of chapter 40 where it describes even a young man's strength failing. And of course, I mean, we have that contrast, if you're thinking about life's continuum, of sort of wisdom in a more advanced stage and youth and strength and energy and all of that when you're younger.
Well, and of course, you're talking to your four kids and your wife at this point.
Yeah, my point to them was to recognize that there are times when your emotional, your intellectual, and your physical strength will fail. And I wanted to encourage them that those are not the periods of time that you want to make critical decisions. And so, I mean, we know that failure is a part of life and that pressures emerge and they will make us very uncomfortable. And we're not always going to, in those moments, offer up our very best resources or make the best decisions. And I think that's just important to recognize that we can endeavor to figure out what our responses will be to various pressures. And while we have full access to our faculties and strengths, then make decisions in that kind of a time frame, in that kind of a space. So, you know, like my little brother likes to say, you fight like you train.
Well, and your little brother does fight like he trains, not just martial arts, but he was one of the first two guys in after the Banda Aceh tsunami wave. And so he's been able to see strength under pressure, making decisions ahead of time. But you're exactly right. You fight like you train, even with flying. You know, you and I both have a past of flying airplanes. You know that the time that you're going to use the thing that you just felt like you overtrained for at that point that you're going to use it is almost always at the point when you wouldn't be able to do that unless you had trained ahead of time for it.
Yep, protocols and training. I mean, we went on a hike this weekend, and it wasn't a particularly strenuous hike, maybe 5 miles round trip. We did put the youngest in front as the designated pathfinder. Thank you for that advice. It's
Yeah, that's right.
But the sun came out. The sun came out. And as soon as the sun was burning and the pitch on the trail increased, I had little voices, which were all joined in one chorus. Let's go back. Let's go home. Right. And it was this little microcosm of psychology, which shifted, and the tone of kind of what I consider trail talk. It went from general cheer to sort of full scale complaining. When will it end? When are we going to rest? When can I have some water? And, you know, I think several things happened prior to that, which I think were important, because before we started the hike, we had talked and we looked at the map and we collectively made up our mind where we were going and when we would break for lunch.
So you had a plan.
Yeah. And I mean, life doesn't always seem to respect the plan. I get that. But at least we set out in our minds with a plan. And there were minor deviations, but we largely stuck with the plan. And I, you know, when the greatest pressure emerged, it wasn't that we refused to make choices under pressure. It was that we had already made the choices prior to the emergence of pressure and didn't allow circumstance to dictate the outcome. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, look, nobody enjoyed the heat of the day. I didn't either, but I have maybe more of a social filter than the little ones do. So, but no one reveled either in the steepest part of the hike. But the decisions were made in our best state of mind and in anticipation of the challenges that were ahead. And, you know, we reached the peak. When we returned home, everybody was grateful to have made it there and back again without giving in to discomfort. And that's, I mean, I reminded them on the path. I said that, you know, get used to it, guys. This is not all of life just feels great, but you do just have to keep on trucking. And, you know, we anticipate discomfort. Back to kind of what we do and our perspective on the markets, we anticipate discomfort in the financial markets. And I anticipate it on a scale that may rival or exceed what occurred in 2008 and 2009. I think it's worth making some of your key allocation decisions now while you have access to your best possible thinking and are not operating with a lizard brain.
You know, it reminds me of the book that John Krakauer wrote called Into Thin Air. And he was talking about the Everest expedition that had made the decision on when they would turn around from the top of the mountain. You and I have talked about this even with 14,000 foot peaks here in Colorado. Sometimes, you know, you're talking about your hike where you stuck it out because you had a plan, but sometimes the plan actually has to know when to give up and when to get out. And, you know, I think about your time at Morgan Stanley, Dave. We brought up 9/11, September 11th. I think it would be worth sharing the story of why some of the Morgan Stanley people actually survived the World Trade Center attack. There was somebody there who had taught them when to get out.
Yeah, there's a certain thing. I don't know if it's muscle memory or what, but I know when I do the triathlons, I think about every transition before it happens. And I lay everything out in just the way I'm going to put it on. When I get out of the lake or the ocean, what am I going to do with my wetsuit? And where do I put my goggles? And what do I do with my shoes? And where are my... No decisions are made when I'm getting out. It's mm-hmm. all laid out, and it's all in a sequence, and I go through it dozens and dozens of times because I know that when I walk up to this little pad of space, I can't try to figure it out in that moment.
You've already swam 1.2 miles. You've either biked maybe 56 miles. I mean, at that point...
This is not the time to philosophize right. or trying to figure out how to optimize. All of that's done ahead of time. When you do a fire drill in school, elementary school, or what have you, I don't know what that is setting in your noetic structures in your mind, but I was with Morgan Stanley when 9/11 occurred, and the training in New York City was a part of that. So I went back for 6 weeks and every day went to the World Trade Center. And that was a part of the firm's program for young recruits.
No, you weren't there at the time that it happened.
No, I wasn't there when the building came down. The challenges on that particular day were in large part mitigated for Morgan Stanley employees because of the decisions and the training imposed on them by Morgan Stanley security detail. There's one man in particular who had worked as a soldier for hire in Rhodesia and then as a British citizen volunteered for the US-Vietnam conflict. After Vietnam, moves to the US, lived just outside of New York City, and took on the management of security protocols for Morgan Stanley. In his free time, he wrote poetry and was a playwright. A really fascinating guy. And this is a man who was constantly thinking about risk and mitigation. That's what he had trained for in the military, and that's what he did in the corporate sector. He had actually anticipated the 1994 World Trade Center bombing. You remember when there was a van driven into the basement and blown up there? And then later, as they were sort of looking at that crisis and trying to anticipate the next, he suggested that the next attack on the building would be aerial. And I mean, he's way ahead of the curve. But he trained everybody from the top executives to secretaries to drill an evacuation plan. And it didn't matter if they were in pinstripes, and it didn't matter to him what was on their schedule for the day. Rick was his name, and he ran a tight ship to which even the CEO was accountable.
Wow.
Right? So the decisions were made, and the plans were drawn up critically before the events of 9/11.
And that ended up saving lives.
It saved lives. Day of the event was not the time to make decisions. It was the time to follow protocols, and it was time to take action according to the plan.
Let's look at the other thing that happened in September, but it was a different year. It was when Lehman Brothers had gotten too far extended. We'd seen a number of other firms actually bailed out, Dave, before Lehman Brothers closed their door. But Lehman Brothers, if they could have anticipated a little bit like Morgan Stanley had anticipated because of this guy, Rick, if Lehman Brothers could have anticipated what was going to happen to the credit markets and to the derivatives markets, maybe they'd still be in business today.
Well, and I don't know if you recall the Bank of America CEO at that time. Here's their version of a plan. If the music's still playing, you have to get up and dance.
Wow. That's their plan.
That was the plan. Look, so the global financial crisis and Lehman Brothers 10 years ago, it was not anticipated. And the risk management professionals involved in those firms were largely put in the basement. Because putting limits and controls on product development meant limits to profit and an allowance for competitors to gain market share. So as a credit cycle wears on, you have risk awareness, which is not elevated as it should be. In fact, it's marginalized because you've got compensation and competition, which are driving the ship.
Let's face it. I mean, this is not the first bank crisis we've ever had. They come fairly predictably.
No, in fact, I mean, it would take us the entire time today if we just wanted to list the litany of bank failures and financial crises which have occurred just since 1970. From 1970 to 2007, there's been no less than 124 banking and financial crises around the globe. That's not going to change.
Right.
Why? Because you have the shortness of memory and the perennial nature of greed, which keeps financial crises always in the incubation and development stages. The more time that goes on, the closer you get to the inevitable. So what you're talking about is compromised lending standards, excessive commitments made against the rosiest of expectations. And ultimately, what you have, just like Lehman, one player taking a larger loss than anticipated, and what it reveals is the cracks and fissures throughout the system, along with the interconnectedness of all those players.
Well, and it definitely was not an unexpected thing. I remember you and your dad, this is in 2006, before the financial crisis, literally hitting the road and giving presentations on the dangers of all these acronym products that were considered derivative types of products. They were all acronyms. Nobody really knew what they meant, but it actually spelled almost $250 billion worth of danger.
Well, here's how you spell doom loop. CDS, CLO, CDO, CDO, CLO squared. And so, yeah, 2006 and 2007, if you're interested, we're going to try to find the old copy of, I think we actually recorded that presentation with our clients.
We should put that on the site.
I'm a little bit embarrassed. It was not my greatest presentation, but the information was interesting.
Were you able to grow a beard at that point?
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. Okay. The reason I've kept it is because it's a very novel thing to me. So now the credit default swaps and all of these derivative products were being hatched by Wall Street to package and repackage debt instruments in that era. Yet very little has changed from then to now. If you're comparing the past to the present and assuming that things have gotten much better, because after all, we've got Dodd-Frank and a whole host of other new oversight measures to keep us safe. CLOs, these are one of the most popular products on the street today. Here in 2018, you've got Wells Fargo estimates this year's issuance at about $150 billion. And again, it's the same stuff, the same crap that we were creating in 2005, 6, and 7. And this time is different because the proliferation of non-bank loans through private equity firms, what it has mirrored is the other forms of shadow banking and lending that avoids the constraints that have been put on banks in recent years. So, you know, we talk about viability during the next crisis, and really what's happened is money has moved underground. It's moved out of a highly monitored, highly scrutinized banking system, and you have tens of trillions of dollars which has emerged within the shadow banking arena, private equity loans, et cetera, just one example. But again, it's now in a sphere that is no more accountable than what we had in that period of 2007 and 2008.
Well, in 2008, I do remember on the commentary when we passed the $1 quadrillion mark on estimated value of derivatives. Now, I don't think the derivatives value is up to that level at this point, is it?
No, and I think what it's comparing, when you think about notional values, it's the traded amount of all of those products. So I think we reached $1.2 quadrillion, and that number has shrunk in terms of the total amount that turns over every year. You know, there's a smaller pool of underlying assets, which is about $12.7 trillion, according to the BIS, and the notional value is no longer above a quadrillion. It's at $542 trillion. But frankly, the 50% shrinkage in notional value, while some will say, look, we don't have to worry about the 542, it's just the 12.7. Our conversation with and the writings of Richard Buchstaber support the idea that in a crisis, it's not the 12.7 trillion that matters. It's the 542 trillion that's looking for settlement, that's looking for collateral claims, that's seeking liquidity. And that complicates the game and resembles a free-for-all. So the gross number is absolutely the critical number in the context of crisis. Large volumes that ordinarily don't seek liquidity are constrained by capacity limits in that particular context.
Okay, well, let's look at these debt markets, because really these derivatives are really insurance policies saying, look, you're not going to lose in this area. We'll pay up if that happens. In a way, it's like a Lloyd's of London insurance policy. People put money into it with the idea that it'll probably never be paid out, and there's usually enough there. The problem is it's the other side of things with the derivatives market. There's far more money extended out than could ever. Well, how much money is there in the world compared to how much money is committed through the derivatives market? It's probably a 5-to-1 ratio.
Well, you're talking about the debt markets, and that's very relevant, particularly when you're talking about CDO, CLO, and CDS derivatives. But there's other forms of derivatives, and that's how we get to the 542. Even in the gold market, there's derivatives where you know, you may have 100 times the paper ownership compared to the underlying physical metal. In other words, me and 99 other people say, I own 1,000 ounces of gold, except there's only 100 ounces available. Now, wait a minute. Me and 99 other people own 1,000 ounces, and yet there's only 100 available. You do the math, and you start realizing not all of us can have the only physical gold that's available.
And there's your musical chairs analogy.
There's your musical chairs. So everybody assumes that they have it. And then when you actually want it, you realize that, you know, yes, the 542 matters. The larger number matters relative to the underlying asset base. It absolutely matters. Well, the debt markets, going back to these capacity limits and really the issue being liquidity, the debt markets are periodically vulnerable to the same issue in terms of capacity limits. What is the primary purpose of a fixed income vehicle?
When you're borrowing money, you're looking for working capital.
Yeah, but on the other side of that, you've got the creditor who will hold the loan, or if you're an investor, you buy the loan and you collect interest on the loan during the duration of that loan. So there's a bigger audience of present tense fixed income investors, what we'll call creditors, than there is a receptacle to sell those holdings into if more than a few fixed income investors want out. There's liquidity constraints.
Right.
That's what we're saying. And as we've mentioned ad nauseum, the ETF market has exaggerated the perception of liquidity in the fixed income products in the context of a shrinking market maker role. In other words, you used to have the equivalent of a warehouse that would take in a particular product, both in equities and fixed income. And that warehouse, quote unquote, which is technically called a market maker, has been marginalized and doesn't play the same role that they played even in 2007 and 2008. There's been a structural transformation on Wall Street, and it goes very underrecognized and underappreciated, because ultimately the fragilities in the derivatives market, I think, will be revealed and blown up because of these liquidity strains in the real market, as people want real liquidity.
Well, and I want to be sensitive using this analogy to those who lost loved ones in the 9/11 tragedy. But, you know, you were talking about Rick and his forethought got people out in time. And in a way, it's a little bit like what you're talking about with liquidity, Dave. If you're in the building too long, you cannot get out. That was one of the problems with the World Trade Center when it did come down. There were a lot of people who were in there that had they have left 10 minutes earlier, they would have gotten out of the building. And in a way, we see the same type of thing with the liquidity crisis. Right now, there's no problem because we don't have a crisis. I mean, we may have little signs that there's cracks in the walls, but we don't have a crisis. But when that occurs, will the person be able to get out in time?
Yeah, I mean, it was fascinating because you had a whole host of firms there in the building, right? And a number of Wall Street firms and insurance companies told their employees to just go back to their desk. They were trying to figure out what was going on. The fire alarms were going off, so people were moving towards the exits, and they were told to go back to their desk.
That was in the second building. They had seen the first building get hit, and they were leaving, and then told to go back.
Rick would have nothing of it. He was against the protest of employees, march to the doors, get down the stairs, this is game time, go.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, when you look at the fixed income market, you look at globally $217 trillion in debt. Somehow McKinsey comes up with a variant number, $169 trillion.
Still sounds like a lot of money to me.
Well, $56 trillion of the total is emerging market debt. About $1.9 trillion of those bonds come due this year, according to the Institute for International Finance. Our perception is how we look at things, right? It's the lens through which we see things. And what I'm saying is that today we're fine. Today we're fine. We've got lots of debt in the system, but it doesn't really matter. People are happy to own it. Add a little bit of incline. Let the sun shine. Let it get a little hot, like my kids were experiencing this weekend, and perception begins to change. You go from happy to being miserable. And I tell you what, as soon as we had cloud cover, their attitudes changed again and they were just as happy as could be. These external variables, which you're not in control of, can completely shift your perception. The problem is we have a market that has certain frailties built into it because of its size. And again, when you're at the outer limits of credit expansion, that's when this becomes a real big deal.
In 1987, when I started, Dave, I was 24 years old here when I started working here, so that I could catch up, even though I was taking economics in school and doing all these other things, so that I could catch up. I devoured the Wall Street Journal every morning. Okay. I couldn't wait to get into it. And I remember reading about this guy, Robert Prechter, who had predicted the 1987 crash. And he really, I have to say, that's where he gained his fame, was in 1987, because he was a lone voice. And the Wall Street Journal said that. And he made quite a bit of money for himself and his investors. The reason I bring him up again, because we've been talking about Prechter, is you just got off the phone with Prechter. And he's looking at today's situation very similar to 1987.
Well, I invited his team to join us in the commentary, which I think they'll do in the next week or so, to explore some of these things, because I think we're at a critical turn in the market. Mm-hmm. I mean, he made a critical call in 87, and it was one of the best market calls he made. Not that he's gotten all of his calls right, but the ones that he's nailed, the big ones, I think this may be on his list of big calls.
And you know, it was in 1987 that Richard Buchstaber was trying to piece things together for
managing
the crisis
from
happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it would be great to have Prechter here, because you've got two aspects of the same thing.
Yeah. Prechter and his team today convincingly argue that we hit the peak for the equity markets in January of this year. And, you know, looking at the broadest market composite, the New York Stock Exchange Composite Index, it's recovered roughly 70% of the decline from that point in January, but it's failed to rise to new highs.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the other indexes at new highs, and they've done so on very narrow leadership. In other words, only a few big names have been pulling the index higher. And through the summer months, if you look at the last 7 months since the beginning of the year, and particularly the summer months, on diminishing volumes, right? So a rally through the summer months on diminishing volumes, you know, Bill King has said over and over again, those were the key ingredients coming into every major market decline, including the post-Labor Day peak, which was put in September 1929. So you've got the New York Stock Exchange composite, which peaks in January. You've got a number of the other leading indexes, which have pressed higher. And one thing that's worth noting is that utilities, the Dow Jones Utilities Index, actually peaked in November of 2017. And it, just like the New York Stock Exchange composite, has failed to make new highs.
So you're getting non-confirmations. That's what it's called in the market, where you have certain indexes hitting new highs, but other indexes either struggling or not at all.
Yep. So the significance of non-confirmations of weak volume statistics and broad market non-participation is that rather than having a market which is signaling significant rises from here as imminent, you have a set of mixed signals,
mm-hmm.
right? So you have new highs. They're suggestive of a possible upside to come, and bulls would fully support that. But you've got a short list, which we just mentioned, which also suggests that something in the internal gearing of the market is off.
Then let me ask you a question. Are we on the edge of collapse, or are we on the edge of radical expansion? I mean, if you read Trump's tweets, obviously pre-election tweets, we're on the edge of a radical expansion.
Well, the fascinating thing is prior to 2016 and 7,500 points ago in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, he called the stock market a big fat bubble.
Right.
That's almost 8,000 points ago, we were in a big fat bubble. But today, he says, no, we're going higher, because obviously, look at what he's been able to do to engineer the economy towards greater expansion and success.
Well, let's just look at Apple and Amazon, all right? Something that's never happened in any of our lifetime. We now have companies that the capitalization of the company is over $1 trillion.
Right. So the Elliott Wave team describes the Apple and Amazon market caps at $1 trillion or more as the tombstones for the NASDAQ index.
Something we'll look back and remember as markers.
You know, this last week, reading Fred Hickey's most recent research, I'd have to agree, particularly with Apple, where he points out that the expansion, there's an argument for expansion of service revenues, but the fact remains, this is a company that sells smartphones. And they've gone from having a 23% share of the market to having a 13% share of the
market. That's amazing. I was appalled when I read that statistic. They're down to 13%.
Yeah, they're falling off fast. Samsung now is number one, with their Chinese competitors likely to displace Apple from the number two spot next year.
So they probably have shelves of unsold phones right now.
Well, and as you know from your earlier days, inventories communicate something.
Yeah.
And inventories at Apple, year on year, are increased by 89%. And if you look at their two primary suppliers of parts and the manufacturers for those parts, their inventories are also up, I think, on the order of 30 to 60%. So, you know, in a bear market, fast forward, if we're right and we enter into a bear market here shortly, you've got the global consumer facing economic constraints. And these emerge. And now what happens to Apple and Amazon? I mean, when you get to these kinds of cyclical peaks, you can expect 40 to 60% declines, and it's not uncommon to see as much as 80 or 90% declines in many instances.
You know, I wonder, Dave, if you were to take out, I think of, say, 12 batteries, you know, you're working something that's powered, and you've got 12 batteries, and you, when you test the batteries to see if they're still good, you find out that only two of them were really good, and the rest of them were very, very weak in pulling everything else down. I wonder, if we were to pull Amazon, Apple, some of the FANG stocks out of the S&P 500, how is it doing without those few batteries?
Right. So the S&P 500, without the FANG stocks included, just like the New York Stock Exchange composite, has recovered about 62% of the market decline since January to the present.
So it's far behind if you pull the FANG stocks out.
Right. So we're looking at new highs, and that's very impressive. But if you take out just those few that have done all the heavy lifting, in fact, there's only 10 stocks which are responsible for more than the entire move in the S&P 500 since the beginning of the year. And what that is a narrow channeling of investment dollars into a few names. That is the hallmark of a top. That is what we saw in 1999 and 2000. The reality of narrow investor interest in the momentum players, and again, fascinating if you look at individual investors buying mutual funds and hedge fund holdings today, they're virtually identical in terms of the clustering of what they own. They're all around those names, Amazon, Microsoft, Apple, Netflix. They're the biggest contributors to growth.
So who do you sell it to when you want to sell it, if everybody's clustered into it already?
And your market makers have largely left the room. Prechter and his team have agreed, join the commentary in a few weeks, and want to explore the idea that this is the end of an era. Mm-hmm. So the list of stocks already in bear market territory, I mean, this is fascinating because, again, we're very used to seeing the indexes at highs. But again, I think this is very important. You've got U.S. Steel, which is down 38% this year. You've got Avis down 37%, General Electric down 34%, Symantec down 32%, American Airlines down 32%, Ford down 28%.
These are the blues. These are the old blues.
You think of a bear market as when you're 20% down or more.
Yeah.
Right. So we've got a number of these companies that are not along for the ride. They have not made it to all-time highs. They're underperforming considerably. Kraft Heinz down 28%. MGM down 25%. General Mills down 25%. Tesla down 22%. General Motors down 20%. Facebook down 19%. AT&T down 19%. JetBlue down 17%. I mean, so what is this? What is this? What it's suggesting to us is that we are putting in a secondary top, and that the New York Stock Exchange composite is sending a very important message. We've had 7 months of recovery, but we have not had new highs in the New York Stock Exchange composite.
Well, and the volume's falling, isn't it?
The progress, particularly if you're looking at NASDAQ, where we have had new highs put in, number one, it's attributable to a few big names, and number two, it's on declining volume.
Yeah.
Look at your volume statistics for NASDAQ over the last 3 or 4 months, and the only huge volume days have been liquidation days. It does not bode well. It does not bode well. You've got year-end 2018. You know, we mentioned Gave Cal last week and the week before. They call for a global recession by March of 2019. The question is, when will the equity markets digest that?
Well, if we've learned anything from the past, it's not till after it's over. You remember the tech stock bubble back in the 1990s, as the momentum guys were buying all these incredible stocks that a lot of those companies don't even exist anymore. Those are the ones that crashed the hardest. It's what the momentum buyers bought that disappeared after the crash.
Right. And this is from Fred Hickey's most recent comments. He says, the crowding into a relatively small number of names is even more extreme in September 2000. Mm-hmm. On that pre-Labor Day rally, the favorites among the momentum investors poured into them included Intel, which plunged 82% from its peak to the October 2002 trough, Cisco Systems, the third highest valued stock in the world, which plummeted 90%, Number 10 in terms of stock market capitalization was Nortel, a 99% decline.
These were the Amazons and the Apples of the day, Dave.
Nokia, down 79%. Sun Microsystems, down 94%. EMC down 96%, respectively, the 17th, 18th, and 19th highest valued stocks in the world at the time. The collapse of these market favorites in what was supposed to be a new era for stocks ushered in what became the worst decade for stocks in 110 years.
And Dave, you were a broker at the time for Morgan Stanley. And if we go back and look at that year, we had a crash. We actually had peaked out in March of 2000. And then the market started to look like it was going to go on up to new highs. That was the prediction, that we had already seen the worst, a little bit like this year, where we saw possibly the high of the stock market in January. Now we've seen it recover some, and the talk by a lot of the people, the bulls, are saying, well, it's the sky's the limit from here. Same thing happened in 2000, and then ultimately these tech stocks rolled over. Like you said, a lot of them lost over 90% of their value.
You know, what drives credit market chaos and financial market chaos? Ultimately, a credit-driven boom coming into a retrenchment of real significance, it comes from loans that can't be paid back.
Right.
And the exposures that are revealed under those circumstances. Lehman was simply that. Lots of loans, some of which soured and implicated a number of financial players. And contagion was inevitable. It's not unlike the splitting of atoms in a nuclear reaction. It only takes one to go from, my, what a lovely day for a picnic, to the equivalent of Chernobyl in the financial landscape.
And it's human nature. You would think that concern would naturally grow as the credit bubble grows, but actually people become more and more comfortable the larger the bubble is.
Exactly right. Thinking investors should have a level of concern which is more naturally elevated as credit expands. And it's not the case. As the quantity of loans proliferates, you have the quality of credit which declines, and you have an increase in enthusiasm in that context. So the opposite is true. Well, it's not axiomatic. It's not axiomatic that quality declines as quantity increases. It simply is all too human to gain comfort when you don't have many defaults and you have an increased number of people who want loans, and the best loans have already been made to the most qualified borrowers. And to continue your business of lending, you have to find new bodies. In order to do that, you have to compromise some of your standards. And after all, you haven't had many defaults. So again, it's the looser requirements are there to accommodate a larger gaggle of borrowers. And this happens over and over and over again. You and I have talked about Argentina before. It's only about a dozen and a half, two dozen different defaults that they've had since the 1870s.
They never really pay their debt back.
No. But as quickly as they move through a financial crisis, they start stacking up debt again and then default on it again and stack up the debt again and default on it again. And, you know, we had our own, in case investors are thinking to themselves, yeah, but we're the United States. We've never defaulted on our debt. What do you call the 1933 debacle? What do you call the FDR event where overnight he devalues our currency by 40%?
Right.
You're telling me that's not an implicit default?
Well, how about our lifetime, Dave? I mean, from 1971 on, we've lost 90% of the buying power of the dollar. That's a default.
Of sorts.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a different type of default.
But I would say that overnight devaluation by FDR is evidence that with the stroke of a pen, if a president wants to, on the basis of trade priorities or a penchant towards keeping the system going, they'll do whatever it takes.
I remember when that happened to Mexico. It happened to Russia several times in my career here, but I remember it happened to Mexico at Christmas time. They just literally devalued the peso by half at Christmas time. Everybody just lost half their value.
Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
Merry Christmas. Ho, ho, ho. Well, as time wears on, as credit wears on, you've got the mechanics of lending, which they wear out, and precision is no longer critical for the functioning of the credit machine. Again, as you move further along into a credit cycle. And you know, what happens is you start accepting wider tolerances, and eventually that introduces some slippage, and then eventually what happens after that is you've got some unexpected outcomes.
Well, nobody likes an unexpected outcome. I mean, that's what causes panic.
We all love positive surprise, but if it's surprise of another sort, if it's not positive, we don't like it. But you trigger concern with a downside surprise, and then you enter that realm of sort of the lizard brain. fight or flight.
With no plan in mind.
So I guess what we learned from history and reflecting back over the last 10 years is that financial panics are normal. They're perennial. And we move closer to them occurring even as investor complacency increases.
Well, and we've talked about just a single indicator. If you want to just talk about lizard brain, if you want to be lizard brain about a single indicator, you could actually just watch the PE all the time. Okay, and just go, all right, I'm going to be dumb about every other aspect of the market, but I'm just going to look at what the price of a share is relative to the earnings of a company. Every single time, over and over and over, when it gets above 20 times its earnings, you are going to have a crash.
Now, interestingly, Graham and Dodd, these are the guys who sort of mastered value investing back in the 1920s and 30s. They looked at some anomalies for PEs, and they said, well, the reality is there's periods of time where PE doesn't capture the information you need. It lags by about a year.
Hmm.
And so what they did to smooth that and to make it a relevant indicator is they said you need to smooth it using a 3, 5, or 7 year rolling average. Well, Robert Shiller comes along and he says actually the 10 statistically is the best way of running that rolling average. So now we call it the Shiller PE. Mm-hmm. But actually Graham and Dodd and the Value School have liked this idea of keeping track of PEs for a long time. And again, I mean, this, so that you don't have the anomalies, you smooth it using 3, 5, 7, or 10 year rolling average.
But using that rolling average, I mean, we're above 30 now.
Yep, 32.4. And that's kind of a big deal. Now, if you go to Ed Easterling and the folks at Crestmont Research, they would put the PE today in the 100th percentile. Mm. You know, again, historically, looking back over the decades, that's a 14-decade data set. 14-decade data set. If you look at today's PE, we are in the 100th percentile. Where do you go from the 100th percentile? Do I need to ask that question? I mean, is there kind of an obvious next step?
Okay, now that's the one that's not smoothed out. Where are we if we take Shiller into account?
The Shiller PE lands in the 97th percentile.
Okay.
And that's in line with 1929 and the year 2000, also just above the 97th percentile.
Dave, there's another indicator that we've talked about many times, and it's the Buffett indicator. And it seems to also be a pretty accurate way of looking at whether the market's overvalued or not.
Market cap divided by GDP, or if you take the aggregate value of equities and divide them by GDP, we call it the Buffett indicator, going back to a 2001 Fortune magazine interview where the Oracle of Omaha said it's probably the best single measure of where valuations stand at any given time.
It's very simple.
Now, that
you said market cap over GDP.
Now, that was 2001. Granted, we're moving into the middle of a bear market. Equities have already sold off. And he's saying, yes, this tells us that things are cheap. But if it tells us when things are cheap, doesn't it also tell us when things are expensive? And this is what is galling to me. Because in 2001, at a market low, he's willing to say, and I quote, it's probably the best single measure of where valuations stand at any given time. And now today, it's the second highest level, the Buffett indicator, the second highest level in U.S. financial market history.
Yep.
Yet Buffett somehow proclaims in a CNBC interview this year that the stock market is on the cheap side.
Stocks are a little cheap, but how come he has so much cash?
Well, I mean, so this,
if
that's
stocks are cheap, why is he keeping his money in cash?
This is where you sometimes see the heart of a capitalist. Has he lost his mind, or has he lost his integrity, or something in between? I don't know. I don't want to give you the fallacy of false alternative, but you look at $110 billion in cash.
That's not bargain hunting stocks. That's
that
cash.
That is clearer communication to me.
Yeah.
Than whatever mumbo-jumbo he provides for CNBC and a headline that they can run, which says the stock market is on the cheap side, according to Warren Buffett. Following his favorite indicator, it's the second most expensive market in all of U.S. financial history.
We've had Andrew Smithers on the program several times, and you've gone out to see him in Scotland. And Smithers uses something called Tobin's Q, the Q ratio. Now, I'll be honest, it's not quite as simple as these other ratios. It's a little harder to calculate, but it's been very, very accurate. And I think the Q ratio right now is getting close to where we've been before a crash as well. Is that not the case?
Yeah. And I mean, in a nutshell, a Tobin's Q measures the replacement value of a company and where the current market is above or below that replacement value. Tobin, by the way, got the Nobel Prize for a related study here. And what Tobin's Q looks at is the replacement value of equities and the premium or discount that they're trading above or below that.
So to restart that company and to build that company up that that stock represents, that's the replacement value of that company.
That's right. So if it costs you a dollar to build from the ground up and you can buy it for 50 cents on the dollar, you should buy it.
Sure.
But
sure.
If it's selling at $1.50 and you could start from scratch and build it for a buck, you're overpaying, right? So that's Tobin's Q in a nutshell. When you start trading at premiums, it may trade at one standard deviation above the average mean or two standard deviations. It's only traded at three standard deviations once in all of time.
Was that during the tech stock bubble?
It was. So the Q ratio sits at two standard deviations above the mean today, and that's a level at which all bull markets have collapsed into bear markets, with the exception of the year 2000, where, as I mentioned, the number reaches three standard deviations. What's the context here? Kevin, we've got homogeneous monetary policies, which have boosted global asset prices to records. Now we're witnessing a divergence, a decoupling, where the emerging markets are falling apart first. And you know what's amazing to me is it's only in the West do we somehow think that we are immune. And what this suggests to me is that 2008 and 2009 was not the last time that pride and hubris preceded the fall.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.